right, no, surely what? I mean, if Britain built a Death Star, then the Brexiteers would destroy Europe. And we go, no, 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 but we can trade with the Death Star now. Trade barriers are down.
We've got to make jam and sell it to Yavin.
Hello, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host, and our guest propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. On today's podcast, I'm going to have myself a real good time. I feel alive, and the world, it's turning inside out. I'm floating around in ecstasy. Don't stop me now, don't stop me, because I'm having a good time. I'm a shooting star leaping through the skies, like a tiger defying the laws of gravity. That poor, poor tiger. Imagine, lost in the vast expanse of space. Goldfish bowl helmet jammed over its ears. Drifting lonely through the cosmos. Bouncing off satellites like a furry pinball. Wondering why it can no longer feel the comforting pad of the earth beneath its paws. Longing to leap out of the long grass onto an unsuspecting water buffalo. Craving a bowl of Frosties. Somehow that tortured big cat feels very much a part of the Worst Foot Forward family. And lost in space alongside me is my very own space tiger, covered in hair, widely confused and desperately gasping for oxygen. It's Ben Vandeveld.
Hello.
Hi.
And thankfully I'm not an endangered species as far as I know.
I have always wondered about that lyric.
Well, no, do you know the backstory to that song?
No, go on.
So Don't Stop Me Now apparently was written after an infamous party that Queen threw where Freddie Mercury hired, and let's use that term, 69 rent boys, lined them up, fucked them all, and then wrote, Don't Stop Me Now, I'm having such a good time.
And was rent boy number 69 an actual tiger?
Yeah.
in a sling?
Yeah, at the end he just went, it's great!
It's grim.
Yeah, it is seriously grim.
I thought I'd start with something sort of slightly spacey.
Yeah, because we're going back into space. We've not been into space for about 30 episodes.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've already done the world's worst astronaut, and today we're going to deal with the world's worst space invention, which is you know, we've done the people, now have to do the things.
Yes, the things that are badly used by the people who don't know what they're doing. and it's been suggested by our excellent guest this week, who is an actress, a comic, a radio host and a presenter. You may well have seen her on The Crown, Call the Midwife, Lee Nelson's Well Funny People and Sunny D. When she's not performing as an actress, she is a finalist in the UK Pun Championship and her past two Edinburgh Festival shows have sold out. They are all about science and women in science, and were called One Woman, A Dwarf Planet and Two Cocks, and come on, grow up, and One Woman, A High Flyer and A Flat Bottom. I didn't think you'd go for the second bit of gentle WI filth, but there
yeah,
we are.
I love it.
Anyway, it's the excellent Samantha Baines. Hello, Sam.
Hello.
It's a good sign if I'm already laughing at the show titles.
I should say Cox is spelt with an X, obviously.
Of course,
Brian
yeah.
Cox.
In fact, Brian Cox, yes.
My husband, when he was on, he was doing a show in the Midlands somewhere, he was in Diggs, and one evening he was sat with the woman who owned the house that he was living in. Watching something on the BBC, and then I think a trailer for Planet Earth or Stargazing or one of those things came up with Brian Cox in it, and she actually was on her way through, said, oh, you should watch that. Didn't I hear that you said you liked Cox? And then she realised she should have said Brian before that.
I mean, there's lots of amazing merchandise that you can buy that says, I love Cox. That's with it. Professor Brian, that's me. In tiny writing. Brian's hair is very glossy and wonderful.
Have you met him?
No, never.
I look him in your eyes as if to say, you've been told not to be alone with him.
Lots of people have suggested that they would put us together in a room, including, I did an interview for BBC BBC Six Music, I think it was, and they said that they wanted to get me in a room with him at Christmas, which I'm still waiting for. Hit me up.
With a patched roof of mistletoe above your head.
My whole first show was about learning about the universe to impress Brian Cox, so I've got loads of facts to tell him. But then I realised there's loads of amazing women in space, and I should be trying to impress them instead.
But were they also epic keyboard players in synth pop bands?
He is a dream come true.
There was it's a brilliant photo that's been doing the rounds on Twitter, and I annoyingly forget a name, but of the woman who did the coding for the Apollo, for the moon landings.
Yeah.
And
one of the women in the film, the recent film that came
Yes,
out.
I think so. So she's Hidden
Figures.
Hidden Figures. Yes. Yeah. So she's this tiny little African-American woman, and she stood next to this huge tower of calculations that she did by hand that is, you know, 1.5 times the size of her. And Buzz Aldrin specifically requested that woman do the coding because he didn't trust anyone else to send her into space.
Well, I love the film Hidden Figures. And my newest show, One Woman, A High Flyer and a Flat Bottom, which is on at the Soho Theatre in December, and UK tour, is about lost women of science. So it's kind of a similar theme to that film. Actually, I did want to do a couple of those women. But then there was a film about them and I thought they're probably going to get a bit more exposure from the film than my show. But I'll concentrate on something else. But they were awesome women and they went through so much at the time. Yeah. Like there's a brilliant scene in the film Hidden Figures where the lady who did the moon landing calculations, who I think, I'm going to Google it, I think is Mary Johnson, has to go to the toilet and there's segregated toilets. So she has to run across, you know, the whole NASA compound. And her boss is like, she's been gone for like 20 minutes. What's she doing? And he didn't realise that, you know, not only was she the only woman, she was the only black woman in that department at the time. So she had to,
She's Catherine,
up with so much.
Catherine Johnson, Mary Jackson, and Dorothy Vaughan are the other two main figures in the film.
Yeah, so Catherine Johnson calculated all the amazing sort of trajectories, and Mary Jackson, so similar, was an amazing engineer at NASA, and she like had to go to court to ask if she could study engineering.
That's right, in the state, because it wasn't
a segregated school for white people, essentially, because she needed this qualification.
Yeah, it's incredible, because I remember when I learnt for A level all about the civil rights movement, and you get those terrifying and shocking pictures of like African-American, particularly girls, going to school or university for the first day, and they're there with this fierce go fuck yourself look on their face, are surrounded by screaming white people. And they're really important to learn about, but we need to learn about these women as well, the one who did get the university and did battle through and did end up helping one of the proudest things America has done, even though it wasn't really in the spirit of science. It was just to show Johnny Russian that they were a little bit better than them.
Vladimir Russian.
Vladimir Russian.
America missed out on everything else, didn't they? Getting the first human in space.
That's the funniest thing about that, is that everything was done first by the Russians, apart from the moon landing.
Like,
and that's
we're going to have this one thing.
Yeah.
The Russians even got there with assassinating JFK before the Americans did as well. What was it that sparked your interest in science and space travel and all that jazz?
Brian Cox.
So when
I was younger, I always really liked science and the arts. Mm-hmm. But I guess as a sort of young 16-year-old girl at school at the time, I sort of felt like I wasn't allowed to pick both. And I was kind of sort of encouraged into the arts as an inverted commas easy subject. So I felt a bit dissuaded from the sciences, I guess. I did go to a brilliant school and the teachers were all brilliant, but I definitely felt like, oh, you should do the arts because you're good at that, and science is really hard. But later in life, it sort of was a bit Brian Cox, you know, it was seeing him on TV becoming so mainstream and him combining science and the arts. So bringing creative people together and doing, you know, comedy shows with Robin Ince and making science funny and artistic and creative as well as sciencey, that kind of did it inspire me, and his passion for it kind of got me back into it, and I started sort of looking up. Actually, I had a moment of, shall I give up stand-up comedy because I'm not feeling fulfilled by it. And I sort of went away and thought, what would I like to write about? And let me try that and see if people like to hear it. So I sort of went away and started writing about science.
It's a really welcome part of comedy. And, you know, if I can't be funny, then our shows can be well-researched.
Yeah. That's the motto of this show.
I like combining some penis jokes with some science, yeah. You know, just to add a little bit of different flavour. Flavour's the wrong word.
It is the wrong word. Well, I mean, I think that in many ways, the penis does resemble a design for a space station. Yeah. You know, you've got the long shaft that people live in, and then the two energy modules to either side of it.
And rockets. But, you know, NASA was run by men throughout history, so of course they would choose it.
Are you suggesting
we should have vagina-shaped spaceships?
Let's send our penises into space! Mine's bigger than yours, it's 400 miles up! I think we should.
You're suggesting that if women were running NASA, we'd know more about black holes now than we do.
Yeah, I think I would be the worst astronaut
really
in the world.
Oh, you've got John Young in your sights.
And poor Michael Collins.
And Michael Collins.
But no, he was good at astronauting. He just didn't get any attention.
He just had a bad agent. He was always the...
a marketing team. I think being an astronaut would be absolutely amazing. And, you know, seeing the world, our little tiny planet from so far away and exploring the universe sounds awesome, but practically I think I'd be awful at it because I worry about lots of life and I have a toilet thing where I always go to the toilet before I leave somewhere and I always think about where the next toilet is, you know, because you don't want to get caught out.
Yeah.
And so I met a real astronaut and I asked them about going to the toilet, and apparently you have to strap yourself in a kind of contraption.
It's very specific.
That sucks it out of you.
Yeah.
So it's like a space Dyson for your bits. That was the link. So, and all I could imagine was like the hand dryers in Nando's. You know, like the Dyson hand dryer. So obviously women would have trouble getting it and men you could just dangle. But like, so basically I imagine that on the International Space Station, in the toilet, there's just a little window on the door and through the window you just see someone's face just normally going about their business and all of a sudden it's like in their face. It's just as they get their urine and everything sucked out.
I imagine that for Japanese astronauts they're just like, yeah, that toilet's perfectly normal.
Yeah. Well, no, and then you, in Japan it's amazing because you get all the squirty water and scents and towels.
They talk to you.
That's I think that is actually fine. Ooh. But the toilets, the sucking out of you sounds stressful. And also there's no showers in space.
Yeah.
They trialed a shower and it didn't really work.
The water tanks take up too much space.
Yeah.
So and it's like hand wipes.
Obviously water flies off, doesn't it? Yeah. So they have to like put it into a sort of wipe that essentially becomes like a wet wipe. And I mean, I've been to Glastonbury. I've done that, but I don't think I could live like that for like a year at a time. I need a nice hot shower. Oh, yes. And also things like food, like the food looks horrible.
Yeah.
Although I found out you can have Coca-Cola in space.
Yeah, you can get everywhere.
And not even diet because you're weightless. Yeah. But true story, you can have Coca-Cola in space. And someone's made an espresso machine for space.
Amazing.
So that would be caffeine-wise. Would be fine.
But given that you've got 16 sunrises a day when you're orbiting the Earth anyway.
Yeah, the really hard bit is frothing the milk for the flat white. that goes out into giant space foam that envelops everyone.
I go crazy on caffeine. And I'm also lactose intolerant. So I'd need like a soy alternative. And also, if I do have milk, I fart. And they are bad. And in an enclosed space for a year, like the other astronauts would hate me. So I think I'd just be really bad.
I mean, Elon Musk has just crossed your name out on a giant whiteboard.
As we mentioned, we're going to talk this week about the world's worst space invention. And Ben is going to kick us off.
Let's get right to it. The Death Star.
Which one?
All of them. All of them. I did a little bit of research on Wikipedia.
Yes, my favourite website.
I didn't know it existed until yesterday morning. So, a couple of stats about the Death Star. The original one was 100 to 160 kilometres in diameter and included approximately 1.7 million human personnel, making Luke Skywalker a bigger genocidal maniac than the droppers of both of the H-bombs in Japan. The thing is, the classic thing to accuse the Death Star of being a bad space invention is because it's got this fatal flaw of the vent. But obviously, for those of you who've watched Rogue One, you'll realise that the vent was put in there by someone wanting to rebel against the Empire.
It's an amazing bit of back-splaining in that film.
They've
gone 40 years, people have mocked that fact that such a massive weapon can be undone by a tiny little, basically, exhaust chute.
They've looked for a loophole, like, literally looked.
Or a loophole.
But I thought you were going to say the fatal flaw is that it's called the Death Star. Literally, like, who would want to live on that? Like, if you were moving somewhere.
What's your estate agent?
Or the Death Star?
In the estate agent, looking through the brochure, this looks nice, an apartment on the 54th, the death floor of the Death Star. Lovely views of Endor. Not shower, apparently.
One convenient canteen. In 2012 and 13, there were 30,000 signatures on an American government petition to build a Death Star in order to stimulate the economy.
Well, it would house 1.7 million people. Like, that would, you know, the refugee crisis.
I mean, obviously,
we don't have enough houses.
We
could
don't.
We build a star.
Yeah,
and loads of people, because rich people would pay to buy an apartment on the Death Star, and then we could give their house in Dartford to someone who needs it.
I think they're overlooking this idea of stimulating the economy, though, overlooks the fact that then there's a massive planet destroying weapon hovering in the sky.
Yeah,
I think stock markets might wobble at that.
Would the pound go down even
more? I think so.
And still the Brexiters would be going, no, this is definitely the right decision.
I mean, if Britain built a Death Star, then the Brexiteers would destroy Europe. And we go, no, but we can trade with the Death Star now. Trade barriers are down.
We've got to make jam and sell it to Yavin.
Well, the Death Star could actually be great for the economy, because it would be outside of the tax system, surely, because it's outside of the planet.
Yeah, the trade barriers would be down, but the very real defence barriers would be up, which would be the problem.
We've talked about this on the previous episode, though, that stuff in space sort of belongs to the planet.
Oh, of course.
That basically no one can, all this stuff about buying real estate in the moon or Mars is bollocks, because there are UN treaties that say actually it belongs to the whole planet if we are going to colonise its humankind. But then again... Maybe if people have privately funded the Death Star, maybe they can rightfully claim it to be theirs.
But you can say that about all sorts of things. So, like, we all own the moon, but really we all own the Earth, and we all own everything on the Earth, and no one really owns animals, and all we really own is our body.
Get out, you bloody commie.
Yeah.
The thing is,
who made it to the moon first anyway?
like hippies on Earth, like, I can sort of get that, but, like, the moon is being very corporatized very quickly, and it's the same with Mars. There are no Martian hippies going or moon hippies going, hey man, I'm just going out to smoke a bowl in the Sea of Tranquility.
We don't really own anything.
Catalonia's going to move to Spain.
I was going to space. Say
that'd be great if we get Catalonia, Kurdistan, Scotland, Israel, pop them all on the moon, and just give them like a quarter of the moon each. That'd work really well. I mean, I'm sure somewhere there'll be a Nazi document that went, let's just put the Jews on the moon. Rename it the June.
Or the Death Star.
Or the Death Star.
Hitler would have loved a Death Star.
So, like, don't worry, Shlomo. We're going to build an atmosphere there. We totally are. The US government responded to this petition, firstly going, no, but more specifically going, no, it would cost $850 quadrillion. And to put that in perspective, that is 13,000 times the mineable resources on the planet Earth.
That's, imagine the kid who got asked to do that calculation. It was probably the intern. There's one of these stupid petitions. Can you actually just sit down and crunch the numbers? 17 months later, he comes out with a beard. Yeah. Documents.
months? Can you do a spreadsheet financial plan for making a desktop?
We need it in triplicate.
Yeah, that's definitely the work experience boys have to do.
Presumably that. One of the reasons we can't make it is because we don't have the technology to actually make it. rather than how much it would cost. Like, we physically can't. No, we don't know how.
But, like, when it comes to costing things, and especially in a defence budget, America likes to know about the financials before it knows about the possibilities and the technology underlying it. I read a fun article in the Den of Geek, also because the thing with Death Star, it's in terms of space technology, it's a real kicking yourself in the balls design.
Yeah.
And it referenced like real world things that are similar to it. One was Hitler deciding to attack Russia for no real good reason. But my favourite comparison was James II of Scotland, who obsessed about making this cannon called the Lion,
yes.
And he used it to attack Roxburgh Castle, and it exploded and killed him immediately.
Blew up in his face.
Yeah, and that's like a real world Death Star. So I looked at NASA failures. Now, obviously, this can get bleak, and I've tried to stay away from the bleak shit. A space-based infrared system that was meant to be used to track ballistic launches. It went $10 billion over budget. It shut down after 7 seconds and went into safe mode. And presumably they just like couldn't get it out of safe mode. And a undersecretary for the Ministry of Defence described it as a useless ice cube.
When was this?
This was in the 2010s.
Okay.
There's also NOOAA-19, which was meant to be something to monitor weather, volcanoes and climate satellites.
It's called No.
No. Yeah, and it's NOAA-19, which means the NOAA 1 to 18 presumably worked quite well.
And it's monitoring weather.
Yeah.
Its name is NOAA.
Yeah.
Wow.
That only just, yeah, well spotted.
Good God.
It was developed by Lockheed Martin, more of them in a moment, and basically it was this multi-million pound, very sensitive piece of equipment, and when it came to getting it ready for launch, they'd forgot to bolt it down, and and as they started moving it out of the massive space barn?
Sure, hangar.
Hangar, thank you.
I like a barn with like hay bales and
and
cow.
Loads of Amish engineers.
The Amish space program. A glory to behold.
Yeah, it's just a paper aeroplane.
Baby
yeah.
Jesus.
massive catapult and one guy in a rocking chair.
So NOAA-19, basically they forgot to bolt it down, and soon they moved it out of the hangar. It just fell over and they caused millions of pounds of damage. But my suggestion for the worst space invention is the Mars Climate Orbiter from 1998. It was developed by Lockheed Martin, and these fuckwits get about 10% of Pentagon funding. It was designed to study the atmosphere, it was developed between the British company Lockheed Martin and NASA, and the thruster software was coded in imperial measurements, and the the software from NASA was coded in metric measurements, no one had remembered to convert the pound seconds into Newton seconds, and so it re-entered the atmosphere at the wrong angle and then burnt up, and was completely and utterly useless because of that.
That's amazing.
And it was looking at climate.
Yes.
And then it burnt to death.
Wow. Oh, God, there's a metaphor for what's happening.
My world's worst space invention is the two suit.
What's the two suit?
Well, every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And in space, that's even more prevalent.
Yeah.
And when we're looking at, you know, travelling possibly to Mars, colonising the universe, at some point we're going to have sex.
Yep.
We're going to have sex in space.
Oh no.
At microgravity. And so some people have spent lots of money developing a way that we could have sex in space. Because basically what happens if you try and have sex in space is... if you were to thrust into someone, they would rebound off real far. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. Yeah.
So that you mean...
So they just sort of thrust off.
They thrust off. A vagina in space does not have the muscle control to...
Clamp on.
I mean, don't make it our problem.
No.
I do my weeing exercises where you stop weeing. You
pelvic
know,
floor.
We work on it, but no, it's that you can't, you literally couldn't be strong enough unless you had one of the horror vaginas with the teeth in that horror film.
Surely it could just be solved by woman goes on top and then...
No, but there's no...
Oh, yeah. Well,
so in microgravity, you're floating.
But
so you don't... It's very difficult to stay balanced and know which is top and bottom. You can't stand up.
Of course.
So when astronauts sleep, they have to, like, sort of attach themselves onto the wall so that they don't just drift off and hit each other in the night. So having sex, you spin round and then you... bang against each other and shoot off.
Sounds great.
Right round, baby. I mean, right round like a...
Sounds like a freaking marathon. So anyway, they've spent millions developing the two suit, which was revealed to the world in 2008. And I mean, the people who designed this, I don't want to take anything away from them. Like, well done you. You know, you've come up with a solution to the problem. I just feel like it's not very good. So it is, the description on Wikipedia is, the two suit is designed to facilitate intimacy in weightless environments.
Is it like one of those double sleeping bags?
Designed for sex. Well, essentially what it is it's a onesie. So you wear a onesie. Uh-huh. Your partner wears a onesie.
Are they alien onesies?
With bobbly ears.
They've got cool, like, dinosaurs on them.
Yeah, exactly.
This is where we came from.
Deanie boppers on their heads.
One of you's a xenomorph blue. And the other one's E.T. He's going, phone home.
I think they're just blue suits.
That's a bit fingering.
Come on. But that can't create babies, true. So fingering's easy. Yeah. But
wait, E.T.'s got a magic finger.
It's true.
Well,
who knows what he was doing?
We want the human race to continue rather than E.T.
Good point.
So basically, so they're onesies, and you both wear one, and then at the front of the onesie, there's a flap that you just take down, and then you Velcro yourself to the other person's onesie. Also, why Velcro? Like, Velcro is like the least sexy material.
Also,
like, if you want to attach to something.
Yeah, Velcro near pubes. Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
So you're having sex and you just get a little wax every so often.
Because I was listening to... What was I watching? I was watching a program about Strictly. And, you know, they were talking about those costumes where you rip the costume off and you've got a different costume underneath. And it used to be all with Velcro. Now they do all of that with magnets. Because it's much easier. But obviously in space...
Magnet's
not so useful in space, so they're still stuck with because it works with gravity.
Use a zip or like poppers. I mean, not that
not those
sort
poppers.
Of
poppers.
But if anything, that's going to make it even more difficult.
But that sounds more sexy, doesn't it? Poppers, like Velcro. Also, if Velcro gets wet, cummy Velcro, like. So you just have two...
Tummy Velcro is a space stripper that I never want to watch.
So you just have two people in onesies with flaps on the front, like a cat flap, but you keep your pussy inside. And then you attach to each other. Like, that is not sexy. Also, that would completely kill the mood. I mean, I don't know how... You know, exciting space and sex would be. Space and sex? Sex and space would put on some like sexy music, like Let's Get It On. And you're like floating around with your space suit.
Yeah.
There would be no spontaneous sex. You wouldn't like start kissing and then you'd have to be like, hang on. And they're both put sex suits on.
Trying to kiss through the glass. Gonna...
It's just.
I can't get.
1 second.
More tongue.
Surely you need to be sort of directed by mission control to kind of just like have little boosters on either side of the suit and sort
get
of
into
dock
the right place.
Literally dock together.
Houston, we have liftoff.
Have they? I mean,
they called it, the History Channel called it One Small Step for Humankind in Colonizing the Universe. The two suit. Also, it's called the two suit. It sounds like something like an adult nappy suit.
Yeah.
It's just not sexy.
No.
I mean, I can't imagine that people have had sex in space yet, because there's obviously been a lot more male astronauts than female astronauts, and you can't, and you're not picked as an astronaut to go into space and shag.
I actually looked into it. Officially, nobody has.
Yes, but there have been couples in space. There have been people who've like fallen in love who've both been astronauts, but NASA says they don't know anything about it, which kind of just sounds like something your parents would say. Yeah. Like, they may have sex, but I don't know anything about it. And apparently sex in space is really difficult, obviously, because liquids fly off.
Yeah.
So for us ladies, the jizz walk that you may have done, ladies, you know, like if you're trying to have a baby, obviously the sperm needs to go inside with the condom. But then some of it descends because of gravity. Now, obviously in microgravity, less of it might come out, but normally you sort of have to do this sort of hobble to the toilet and with your hands in between your legs, so you might catch some so you don't have a stain on the carpet. So I don't know how that would work in space because liquids fly off. Also, apparently male and female arousal is harder in space because of the lack of gravity. Blood goes to your head.
Yeah, I've used that excuse all the time. It's like, God, darling, it's just the gravity's very low in my bedroom.
Yeah, I've been watching Apollo 13. I'm not going. Because that's why people come back, astronauts come back to planet Earth and their heads tend to be swollen and they've grown a couple of inches because fluids go to all sorts of weird place in the body they don't normally go.
And that's why they can't walk. That's why they're always carried out of their landing modules.
My favourite thing about when people arrive back on Earth is they forget that stuff doesn't float. You've got astronauts who arrive back on planet Earth who've been up in space on like the ISS or something for a year, who've gotten used to you not having to put anything down. And suddenly you're like dropping books and cups of coffee and all of that.
Oh, no. Yeah. Also, sorry, testosterone levels fall in space.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. And apparently we don't know why, and they come back to normal levels when you get back. So again, like sort of sex drive and libido. So wanking in space is a bit of a touchy subject. But I just think it doesn't sound sexy. Also, your muscles shrink in space, like your leg muscles, because you're not using them so much. Yeah. Maybe other muscles shrink, which would be something that I'd, you know, is the key muscle still in working order, the one you need to for the baby.
The other thing is, when they're in their spacesuits, they're wearing nappies.
Maybe astronauts need to be into a certain type of
sexy
time.
Yeah. So also, we've got to do like a psych evaluation, fitness test. Yeah. What porn do you watch?
And American astronauts aren't allowed to watch porn.
No,
Russians are in space on the International Space Station. Apparently, American astronauts aren't allowed to watch porn.
Well, as in they've got a firewall up against porn websites?
Well, I don't
know,
but they just—I found out that they're not allowed.
But the Russians are.
Yeah, obviously. They do everything first, even wank.
For space.
The first space wank.
They're so bitter about not getting to the moon that they're literally going to a list of verbs, being the first in space to cook, first in space to jump, first in space to wank.
I wonder about, because you know there's lots of stuff about people who go into space, and particularly about people who walked on the moon, they come back changed. You'd be, surprisingly, because it's a hell of a psychological thing to go through. Just imagine if we do, never mind getting to Mars, if we manage to conceive a child in space, surely that child's going to have something wrong with it.
Well, yeah, because also we don't know that pregnancy in space can happen because the high radiation levels would probably cause cell mutation. And because of microgravity, the bones in the baby could form differently.
Yeah, because everything on Earth looks like it looks because it's grown up on Earth.
Mm.
You bring stuff into space. You bring, like, I've seen pictures of moss in space. And moss grows the way it grows because of gravity and the different forces that act on it on Earth and different gas in the atmosphere. And moss in space grows in these weird concentric circles, like in all directions all at once, because it's loosed from the atmosphere. So
humans might not look like humans. Humans might not look like humans. Space.
Well, we might just end up looking like sort of a weird soupy mess.
We'd look looser, I think. less compact.
We would if we were using the space sex suit. We'd be looser. Also, like, obviously the point is that their thinking is to sort of colonise and have babies. But also sex is quite fun.
Yeah.
And also same-sex couples probably going to want to have sex in space too. And this just has a flap at the front. So there's really, like, access issues, you know. And also sometimes you want to try some different positions going on.
Space cowboy boy again.
Yeah. Oh, go on. Who's on top? No one knows. But I think you just have a belt. That would be easier. Like, instead of a whole suit, just have a belt that keeps you together, and then you can sort of move in and out of it. Or have like a sex pod. So it's like a tube, like an MRI. It's a tube, and you just both go in. So it keeps you really close together, and it's long and thin, but then you can sort of
move
around. With a slight
hump at around hip height.
Yeah.
Just moving up and down.
So you can, and you can have a bit of privacy because you can shut yourselves into the to the sex pod.
Like that Channel 4 show, Sex Box, with Mariella Frostrup did, where a couple went into a little cabin and had sex. And then we came out and asked them how it was.
Yeah. And then Alan Hansen was there afterwards doing the...
post-match analysis.
Yeah.
Post-match anal.
You know, like, you can... Because you can get sleep pods, can't you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like, in hotels in Japan, they have, like, tiny sleep pods where you sort of just go in and it's big enough for one person to
and
sleep.
And they've got memory foam. That was invented for space travel, so, you know, you could mould yourselves into it.
That sounds sexy. Oh,
some pre-sex moulding.
Memory foam. Sex pod.
Well, I'm really up for it. Can you just lie in the one position for 15 minutes first, though, please?
Also, like, oh, is this my sex pod or your sex pod? I don't know. Let me just go and check the shape of my buttocks.
It's like Cinderella in space with asses.
Thing is, only the Russians get to watch sex pods. The Americans are desperately trying to get it on their laptops.
That everyone knows the story about, oh, America spent ages developing the space biro and then the Russians used a pencil, that story. Not true. What did happen was during Project Gemini in 1965, NASA bought 34 mechanical pencils, the little tick-tick-tick-tick, the ones you press without the... So it wouldn't have shavings, basically, because that was the big problem, that if you compared a pencil in space, dust and shavings would get into machinery. But these mechanical pencils, they bought 34 of them at $128.89 each. That is an expensive pencil. So there was obviously a public outcry about it. And they eventually had to equip their astronauts with less costly pencils. And there was still the worry about debris in the spaceship.
Sorry, I have two issues there straight off the bat. Firstly, those little mechanical
ones,
the clicky ones, they break all the time.
Yeah,
so the lead will break off and get in the machinery. And also, why not just have a pencil sharpener with the little bin in it that you...
You would have thought, but
no.
But
then the dust would
the
come
dust
out
The dust would still come out.
Okay.
But the clicky pens... I mean, you could use those, but they're like a pound.
Not in 1965, apparently. Or else there was one pencil company that really upsold.
They were like, guys, this is NASA. We can really bump the prices up.
At the same time as all this was happening, a guy called Paul C. Fisher of the Fisher Pen Company, he put $1 million of his own money into developing a pressurized pen, which would work in zero gravity, would work underwater, it would work in other liquids and at really extreme temperatures from the minuses to the high hundreds plus. And he offered the pencil to NASA. So it wasn't that NASA poured loads of money into this idea. He came up with this idea and then brought it to NASA. And after a couple of years of testing, because they'd obviously been burnt before with their expensive pencils, they eventually bought 400 of them at just $6 a unit in 1967, which seems cheap compared to the other pencils.
Yeah.
But then obviously Fisher could then sell a bunch of pencils to everyone else on the base that he was the guy who, or pens rather, he was the guy who provided pens to NASA. And interestingly
enough,
great marketing, because you just go, because then he set up a separate company called the Fisher Space Pen Company, and that was their big deal. And the Soviets bought 100 of his pens as well, and 1,000 of the replacement ink cartridges in 1969 for Soyuz
for like $6.
Yeah.
That's Fisher Price. Do you remember those cars? Do you remember those children's cars?
Fisher Price
cars.
Oh my god. Oh, the little red ones with the yellow roof.
Yes.
Yeah.
I had so many tantrums in kids' shops because my parents wouldn't get me one.
Oh,
and my cousin had one. And every time we went round, I would kick him out when I was older and use the
You
car.
Would carjack your cousin
yeah,
as a toddler.
Yes. I was mean.
Oh, God.
Anyway, space pens.
Yeah. I want to mention an old friend of the podcast, John Young.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So on our World's Worst Astronaut story episode, we talked about John Young farting in space and eating a corned beef sandwich. I found a couple more John Young stories.
Did he fart in space?
Oh, yeah. He's recorded. Because obviously
everyone's farted in space.
Yeah, but he was the one who was recorded talking about it on the NASA. You know,
is
they had to record all the... He didn't talk about it. Now, he did take
follow
some
through would be different in space.
That's exactly what this bit of is about. So they record all the radio conversations between Houston and the space stations or the shuttles or whatever. They were always having a problem with astronauts swearing and saying things like that. Anyway, this one conversation happened on the Apollo 10 mission. Young is in the middle of this conversation with Lunar Module pilot Eugene Cernan and Commander Thomas Stafford. Who did it? Who did what? What? Who did it? Laughter. Where did that come from? Give me a napkin, quick. There's a turd floating through the air. I didn't do it. It ain't one of mine. I don't think it's one of mine. Mine was a little more sticky than that. Throw that away. God almighty.
I love the God almighty bit.
The God almighty is John Young.
That's the sort of thing you'd say if you saw like a space monster coming into view.
God help us all. So yeah, John Young caught in a conversation about a floating turd in space.
Oh my God. So, because on Earth, if that were to happen, you can you style it out. Like, no one would know. You just walk strangely to the nearest toilet.
Yeah, yeah.
But in space, everyone knows.
Yeah, yeah.
In the space, no one can hear you scream, but everyone can hear you
shit.
He also, John Young, tasted moon dust.
I was going to wonder what you said he tasted.
Yeah, yeah. Because moon dust on Earth apparently has no real smell. Because it's been affected by the different atmosphere. But in space, various astronauts have said that it smells of wet ashes in a fireplace or spent gunpowder.
That's left over from the Big Bang.
Yeah, you would imagine. But obviously on the moon itself, they're not able to, you know, open their helmet and lift up and taste a bit of the moon dust. But John Young, when he got back into the module, had loads of dust on the bottom of his shoes. He hadn't been able to shake any of it off, so he scraped it off and had a little taste. And he said, it doesn't taste half bad.
Why did they let this fucking Mr. Bean go into space?
I love him.
He's so good. I love him so much.
You know, like, the Kardashians do, like, reality TV shows. He needs to do one in space. Yeah. It would be, like, a similar level.
He reminds me of that, whoever the lead pig is in Pigs in Space.
Like, not Hogthrob.
Very good. Hogthrob, that is a really filthy name for the Muppets.
Link Hogthrob.
Yeah, he's got a real bit of Link about him.
Yeah.
Also, I love that moon dust smells like gunpowder. And you know, you said it was left over from the Big Bang. I like to imagine in the future when we discover the real history of the universe, there's like a gunpowder plot like there was with Parliament. And some aliens just came and tried to blow up the universe. And that's actually what we call the Big Bang.
Quite a blow-up.
But it was just them trying to cause a political statement.
Speaking of gunpowder, there is a story about one of the first people who tried to travel to space, obviously apocryphal, about a Chinese, a Mandarin called Wang Tu, or Wan Hu, depending on which version of the story you read, who either lived about 2,000 years BC or in the 1500s AD. But the two stories are largely the same. This is a telling of the story from a 1909 issue of the Scientific American. Tradition asserts that the first to sacrifice himself to the problem of flying was Wang Tu, a Chinese Mandarin of about 2,000 years BC, who, having had constructed a pair of large, parallel and horizontal kites, seated himself in a chair fixed between them while 47 attendants, each with a candle, ignited 47 rockets placed beneath the apparatus. But the rocket under the chair exploded, burning the Mandarin, and so angered the Emperor that he ordered a severe paddling for Wang.
Nothing funny there.
Nothing at all. He got paddled, having blown himself up.
Was he trying to go to space, though, or was he trying to fly?
It seems like he was trying to be one of the first rocket travellers, first sort of rocket technology. But yeah, he almost certainly didn't exist. Given that gunpowder didn't exist till about 3,000 years after that story is meant to have taken place.
I love his initiative, though.
47 is a very specific number, isn't it?
And also, like, just do it yourself. Like, kites fly. Yeah, I'll get a couple of those. Rockets. Let's do it.
The Apollo 11 astronauts, you know how they got life insurance? No, life insurance is obviously very expensive, and a lot of people had died in some of the test missions for the Apollos. And so Aldrin Armstrong and Collins hit on an idea. Basically, as soon as they were announced as Apollo astronauts, they ended up signing autographs everywhere they went. That people just want. Space travel in the 60s was the glamour thing.
Yeah.
And so for a month before they were meant to go to space, they were put into quarantine. And while in quarantine, they asked for lots of Apollo 11 commemorative covers, which are basically these kind of half postcard, half envelope things. So one half is so you can write an address on, and the other half has like a picture of the moon and the Apollo 11 seal and all that stuff. And so for a month in quarantine, they just sat there, all three of them signing signature, all three of them with one signature, all three signatures on one piece of paper. And then when they were released, before they went to space, they gave them to a friend of theirs who, on the day of the launch, on the day of the moon landing, and on the day of the return to Earth, would post them to their friends or their families, because then they would have the postmark date of these significant events and the three signatures all on this one piece of paper. So if they did die, the family would have these very valuable things that they could sell and make money from and use as life insurance.
Love that.
And they still sell even now for like $30,000 a pop.
That's so clever.
It's amazing,
lovely,
isn't it?
Business.
It's a great idea. Before eBay, they just realised there's money in this.
How morbid must that have been, signing all of them, yeah, being like, we might die, this is why we're doing this.
Yeah, well, fail to prepare, prepare to fail. So,
okay.
Prepare for the worst.
Well, there's lots of... When NASA is sort of auditioning for a new astronaut... Not auditioning, interviewing.
Just do the TV show, so that would have had auditions.
Yeah, well, of course, no, Kubrick obviously had to audition for the fake.
Could you just do the song, please?
Yeah. Oh, God, it's like Believe I Can Fly again. No, but it wasn't just that you had to be physically fit and hugely skilled. You had to be an immense problem solver, because shit will always go wrong in space. Yeah. So this is just these three men being excellent problem solvers.
Yeah, it was incredible. You talked about space food. John Glenn was the first US astronaut to eat in space in 1962 on board Friendship 7. And at the time, they didn't know if we could eat in space. Like, everything they were doing in space was for the first time, didn't know if we'd be able to properly, you know, metabolize the food and keep it down. And so he ate applesauce from a tube with some sugar tablets and water initially to test if he could do it. And basically the food that he got was in these like little aluminium like paint tubes. They look horrendous. They're really horrible. He had some that had pureed beef and vegetables in them. Like, then on the Gemini missions, they used to feed them 2,500 calories, which is less than you're meant to get on Earth. They sort of thought you exert less in space than you do on because of zero gravity. But I think now they might think, actually, you should probably eat a little bit more.
Well, Tim Peake did a marathon in space.
Yeah.
So hopefully he was having more.
He did what?
Yeah, he ran...
on a treadmill. 99% of the food in the moisture in food has to be removed, at the time be removed, because of the weight.
So no cucumbers in space.
Yeah, well, it was just all, it would be stuff that you'd have to rehydrate. And actually, Whirlpool made and packaged a lot of the food for NASA because it had to be vacuum packed. On Christmas Eve 1968, the Apollo 8 astronauts ate some thermostabilized turkey gravy and cranberry sauce. So they were able to eat it with a spoon. It was already warm. It was kept in these special pouches, which were bigger than your normal food pouches would be. But they said they didn't know what they were, and they opened them up on Christmas Eve, and they found they'd been sent Christmas dinner.
Aww. It was quite sweet. Christmas dinner. Yeah. And apparently when the sort of supply ships come with new food, there's certain foods that sort of perish quicker, so they all get really excited because they can have cool food.
Yeah, well, now in space they've got refrigerators and freezers and things, so they can have coffee and ice cream is their favourite food they had on the Skylab space station, and they got canning as well, so things are able to keep a bit longer. But in 1975, I didn't realise this mission existed. There was an Apollo-Soyuz test project where an Apollo and a Soyuz craft docked with each other, and American and Soviet astronauts and cosmonauts met each other, and they shared food. So the two US astronauts who visited Soyuz, they ate some of the Russian space food, which included some tubes of borscht, which is a beet soup, which there's a picture of the guys holding them, but they've stuck vodka labels on top of the tubes, jellied beef tongue, Riga bread, and caviar.
Russians having a lovely old time in space.
Wanking and eating caviar. What a lovely time.
I really want to see the Soviet poster of that, with them looking super heroic, jacking off. And
little black balls and little white balls.
That is bubble tea I never want to drink.
But my candidate for the world's best space invention is the Mir space station. Because basically, when I was growing up, there used to always be stories of Mir having troubles all the time, constantly. And so I read a bit about it. It was the first continuously inhabited space station in orbit. And it was occupied for 12 and a half out of the 15 years it was up there. It was up from 1986 to 2001. It was only meant to be up there for 5 years. So it's kind of understandable that shit started to go wrong on Mir.
Especially the second-hand car of...
Yeah,
well, if you go, oh, we're going on a flight to Marbella on a plane that was only meant to fly for 5 years, but it's now in its 15th year of service, you'd be a bit awkward about that.
Oh, it's Ryanair.
Yeah, it's Ryanair. But yeah, they were constantly suffering computer crashes and uncontrolled tumbles through space, which is not a phrase you want to make. Power losses.
Sounds like the Tusu.
Yeah. There's an astronaut called Jerry Linenger who spent some time on the craft, who said that coolant leaks from the aircon and the air units made the air really unpleasant to breathe. And it was only he realised after a spacewalk, when he was breathing the oxygen from the tank, that he then came back in and started breathing the air in the space station. He realised how bad the air in the space station was compared to the tank air. It collided with a Soyuz craft in January 1994. It then suffered a 90-second fire in February 1997, although Linenger was on the craft at the time, said it lasted 14 minutes. The official account says it was only 90 seconds.
God, because it's so flammable. And all that oxygen.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. The smoke apparently stayed in the craft for 45 minutes afterwards. It was really big trouble of ventilating, getting back out. They were wearing respirators, some of which were broken. There were new fire extinguishers, because they kept adding new bits to the space station when they needed new stuff. They'd dock a new bit and sort of release the old bit. And some of the fire extinguishers and one of the new bits of the space station were nailed to the wall. You weren't able to take them off. But the most dangerous moment they had was in June 1997, when there was a crash with a spacecraft led one of the modules, Spectre, to be completely depressurized, which led to the whole space station being depressurized. Why? Their solar panels were damaged, which they were the big source of energy, so this craft just knocked a load of them off. That was June, and it took till October to completely restore the panels to about a 70% ability to get the power going again.
How did they not all die?
They had enough time to seal off that bit of the space station. Basically, Spectre was left sealed off for the rest of the mission. It was just like a completely useless limb hanging off the whole thing.
God. Why would you name a part of a space station after the evil organisation in James Bond and not expect this shit to happen?
Questionable decision, yeah. So, our three candidates for the world's worst space invention are Ben's suggestion of Lockheed Martin's ill-fated Imperial versus Metric Mars Climate Orbiter, Sam's suggestion of the Tusuit, the least sexy romper suit you've ever seen, and my suggestion of Mir, the little space station that could but shouldn't have.
A little question on that immediately, is there any romper suit that is sexy?
Adult romper suits. You get adult romper suits now, don't you? They're kind of a thing.
Yeah, they are, but they're not sexy. Like,
I love that you both looked at me like, yeah, do you know Sam? Do you have a sexy romper suit?
Look, you seem to be an expert on the Tusuit.
Yeah.
I just feel like, obviously, like, some clothing rather than no clothing can often be sexier, but the romper suit is too much clothing to be sexy. You know, like a gentle reveal from a romper suit, I just can't imagine being that sexy.
It's got the word romp in it, though.
Yeah.
I've got a favourite for this, because I feel like Lockheed Martin's The Climate Orbiter and Mir, there's so many ill-fated space missions. Whereas the Tusuit is exactly the sort of space invention-y bullshit that people will have poured millions of dollars into to try and solve a problem that will probably eventually be solved by people going, why don't we just, you know, get a funnel? It'll eventually be something really banal that'll solve the whole problem.
Like, have you switched it on?
Yeah.
Like that sort of IT classic.
So I am going to pick the Tusuit as the world's worst space invention. Congratulations, Sam.
Good.
Before we go, I've got some of the world's worst news of the week, and this comes from the Daily Mirror. Well, it comes from Marie Claire via the Daily Mirror. Former royal private chef Darren O'Grady has been dishing the dirt on some of the royals' favourite foods. Princes William and Harry love a McDonald's. We know that the Queen uses Tupperware. The most depressing news is that Prince Philip swaps meals with his staff. O'Grady regaled the interviewer with a story of being in the kitchen in one of the royal residences, preparing little 1-inch eyes of lamb for the royal dinner that night, and Prince Philip came into the kitchen.
Eyes?
Like little round circular bits of lamb.
Yeah. Oh, not actual lamb's eyes.
Not actual lamb's eyes. No, they're an aperitif at best, not dinner.
I would swap that.
Yeah, and Prince Philip came into the kitchen, saw the what was being prepared, and then saw over in the corner some big lamb chops and said, oh, what are they? probably in between some racist epithets, said, what are they? And he said, oh, they're lamb chops, Your Highness. And he said, who are they for? He said, oh, the staff are eating those. And he said, well, can we have those? And so they obviously had to do His Highness's bidding and provided the royal family with large lamb chops while the staff had to eat tiny little one-inch round bits of lamb for dinner.
Is this the chef doing a reveal?
Yeah.
So the chef is basically saying the royal family don't want to eat the food I've cooked them. Which is a weird thing to go to the press about.
Yeah, so Prince Philip, he's one step away from, you know, rooting through the bins.
What, like a fox?
Like a
That's
fox.
Dangerous because the rest of the royals will come after him.
That's the way he'd want to go. Hunted by, yeah. Hunted by his own grandchildren.
Well, and then his tail, which he obviously has because he's a lizard, will be daubed over George and Charlotte's head.
Before we go, Sam, where can people find out more about you and your work?
They can go to my website, samanthabaines.com, B-A-I-N-E-S. And I'm on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, just search my name. And I have a podcast, Baines Plus One, iTunes.
And when are your Soho dates?
Yes, so I'm doing the Soho Theatre with my show One Woman, High Flyer and a Flat Bottom about the lost women of science from the 4th to the 6th of December 2017 at the Soho Theatre at 9 p.m. And I'm doing a UK tour as well, so go to my website for all the dates.
Very, very good. Meanwhile, we're all off to try and get into my three suit. Sexy romper time. Thank you for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.
It's got so many flaps.
I have to say, when Sam suggested that, I was like, oh, are we really going to find anything for this? It seems such a specific topic, but actually, once you dug into it, some great stuff in there. I love people who can calculate things in imperial when it should be in metric.
Is if we just stuck with imperial, that would never have happened. So thank you, Brussels. Sam, as well, as she spoke about on the podcast, she's on at the Soho Theatre this coming week, and she's got a book of poetry called Poentry that you can see in actual bookshops. So they are cracking stocking fillers, so grab one of those as well.
A bookshop is a place where you buy bits of paper between bits of cardboard, for the younger listeners,
yes.
for whom a book is a podcast. Here's the adverts. If you enjoyed the show, give us a...
No, you don't get adverts in a book. Here's the appendix.
Here's the weird, like, bit at the back of the book where it would have, like, the black and white covers of other books in a series you could buy. Do you ever have those?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love those. You'd read, a book of the Hardy Boys like I did as a kid.
What, the WWE Tag Team Champions?
No, the Hardy Boys... Have you never... Oh, hang on. Is this another cultural touchstone you don't know about?
Is it an Irish cultural touchstone?
No, they're an American duo of crime-fighting kids. Brother and sister, Frank and Joe Hardy... They would go around solving mysteries. They're like
and
Nancy.
And then jumping off ladders, doing backflips and landing on the
No, that's the
table.
Wrestlers, Ben. They're
okay.
Completely different people.
Right.
But they would tag. They'd hang around with Nancy Drew. They're the same sort of thing as Nancy Drew. You know who Nancy Drew is?
Nancy Drew is a code breaker from the
40s. Oh, my God. Listen, every time you talk about me as being, like, culturally knowledgeable when I don't know about the Beatles or jazz, this is coming back to haunt you now. Because baseline, you should know who the Nancy boys is about to say. The Nancy boys and Hardy Drew are. Why did we get into that?
I've no idea.
Anyway, here are the adverts. If you enjoy the show, follow us on Twitter at WorstFoot. Ben is on there as well at Ben Vandeveld. I'm at Vaz Maxtay. Find us on Facebook, WorstFoot Forward. And give us a look up on iTunes or Stitcher. Give us a rating, a review. And send us an email on worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com if you have any suggestions for guests or ideas for topics. Also, you know, this is several weeks down the line since it happened, but you will probably have noticed we changed our artwork a few weeks ago. We want to give a shout out to Aubrey Chanté, our lovely friend who did the excellent cartoon of a very worst foot being put forward, which is our new logo. So thank you, Aubrey, if you want to check her out. What's her website?
So the two things to look up are Curio Sapens is her general website. She does loads of different creative stuff.
and the specific drawings are something called Whimsadoodles. Mm. And Aubrey's amazing at giveaway stuff for free, particularly if you are a primary school teacher, a secondary school teacher, or also someone who's involved in sort of drawing to help with mental health. She's got loads of resources for that.
Next week's a classic episode of the show, one that neither of us were on firm footing for. We talk about the world's worst blaxploitation film.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, it's an obvious topic for Ben and I to talk about. With the excellent Masood Mylas, another stand-up who really knows how to rock big hair and a trench coat.
He really does.
Yeah, he struts into our lives. If you've listened to the World's Worst Monarch episode by now, you know that we were on quite firm footing. Next week feels very much that we're both adrift.
Yeah, we are not in Kansas anymore.